Okay, welcome everybody to the Climate Literacy Network conference call. Are there any announcements from anybody? Ongoing activities or things people want to mention?
Well, I actually have a question. It's Laura Tenenbaum.
Sure, go ahead.
Apologize. It's kind of a dorky question, but I don't know. Dorky questions are okay in my mind. Sorry, I have my computer volume on too. The dorky question is, some of you guys I feel like are really good kind of broadcasters and disseminators, and you send out all these emails, and I'm kind of insecure about that. I just don't do it. And I'm wondering if I wanted something broadcast, could I, like, have somebody who feels really comfortable about sending out a lot of emails? You know, this group seems like people are really good at that. Do you understand the question?
What do you mean? Like sending out multiple emails?
Well, no. Okay, like it has to do with this. I'm thinking about, you know, how our website, climate.nasa.gov, has a blog. And I was thinking about maybe contributing to the blog once school starts and I start to teach climate in the classroom. And I was thinking, because people on this, the Climate Literacy Network, they're really good at kind of following blogs and responding to stuff and getting dialogues going. And I just feel like that's not my best skill, so it's good to kind of partner with people who have that skill.
So do you want somebody to contribute, make contributions to the blog or respond to the blog?
That would be fantastic. No, I'd more like make comments to it.
Whoever has the music, could you please mute that? Thanks. One of the things you can do is you can put it, I mean, you can certainly send, I don't know if you could automatically have it when a posting is put up, had an automatic post to the Climate Literacy Network listserv. It could also potentially be posted on the Clean Facebook page to get the message out there more.
I just think that there's people in this group. I mean, maybe it was a dorky question, but I do think that there's people in this group who have a great skill of disseminating or connecting. And I just think there's a lot of value in that, and not everybody is kind of a natural at that type of thing.
Well, I actually think that it's an issue that a lot of groups, I mean, some groups have get that naturally going, and I know that we've been struggling and clean with having people respond to things and have a conversation going. So, anybody who's interested in contributing, certainly go ahead. That would be great.
And I may send out just some little notices to all the CLN people. And, you know, I just want to say that I appreciate anybody who wants to pass anything forward into the greater universe of internet.
Okay. Great. Are there any other announcements or requests? One thing I just want to mention is that we've been having quite a few presentations on the Climate Literacy Network call, but not every week is scheduled, and we're not trying to schedule every week. But if there are issues that you would like to have discussed, broader issues that you don't actually are presenting about, you can let us know, and we can schedule one of our sessions for a discussion around a particular topic, even if there's not a specific presentation around it. So that was one thing I wanted to mention. The other is to reiterate what the presentation was last week with respect to the clean services, and that those of you who may be involved in climate change education proposals, the slides and the audio recording are available, and I'm happy to talk to anybody if they want to engage in a discussion about how CLEAN might be able to support their projects. So are there any other announcements?
Tamara, this is Karen Holwig. I have a question, and I know a year or two ago we discussed this, and I just don't remember where we came down on it. There have been several comments lately electronically in our emails about the role of faith-based leaders in conveying climate change messages and so forth. Mm-hmm. And what I don't recall is the degree to which we decided we wanted to focus on K-12 and maybe higher education too, or whether we really want to get into that. I have absolutely no objection to the kinds of emails that have been posted, but I'm wondering whether if there are people in the group that have had experience with faith-based communities that have been especially productive, whether that might be a topic or whether that's out of limits or... So that's my question.
No, actually, so Karen, first of all, that's quite within limits. The intent for the Climate Literacy Network is to be as broad as possible. The Clean Pathway Project is focused on middle school, high school, and undergraduate level educational activities and resources,
right?
Because of the funding that we had to be constrained in some way.
Yep.
But we really want to open the discussion here as wide as possible. To that end, in your particular question about faith-based communities, Karen McNeil is the PI of the CLPSE project. That's Climate Change Education in the Southeast United States. And a huge focus of that effort is faith-based communities. And she gave a presentation in November on the Climate Literacy Network call. And the slides
and
recording
it. Good.
Are... I believe it was in November, but I can double check with that on that if you need to. But I would like to have this open to any community climate change touches everybody, as everybody on this call knows, and all different kinds of disciplines. And I think it's important to have that open discussion here. So.
And several of the postings, I especially think of Eugenia's comment and her links to people who have been turned around, decliners, who have been turned around by faith-based leaders that they respect and really listen to.
Mm-hmm. It's been something that came up in the NRC's Climate Change Education Roundtable, not the past workshop, but the one before that, where they talked about people within the faith, scientists, climate scientists, who actually are within a particular faith-based community can have a very strong voice there because they're a trusted voice, because they come from within that community rather than from outside.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks.
Yeah, there was a fantastic speaker last, the Ecology and Education Summit that ESA and NEA put on. Was that a year and a half or 2 years ago? And there was someone from the National Council of Churches, I believe, I'm trying to remember what her name was, who just talked about that facet. And she would be a great speaker, actually, on one of our calls, just talking about connecting with those communities. She actually had a leg up because when you talk about responsibility and moral responsibility, you already are talking to a population that knows that message.
Who's that person?
I'm trying to remember. I'm looking now.
You can send it to me by email.
Yeah, I'll send it to you when I find it.
Okay, great.
Find the CLPSE presentation. It's November 8th, in case anybody else is interested. Thanks.
This is Martha Shaw, and I've worked a lot with the Temple of Understanding in these groups at the UN, and I think that's a good topic maybe down the road. Mm-hmm. Van Jones talks about that quite a bit. When everything hits the fan, people do, wind them in their back of the church and start turning to religion, even as crises get worse and worse. That's usually where they go. He said, if you start, working more with the faith-based groups, then you get a more global look at it, and I would refer people to the Temple of Understanding. I had another announcement to make, too.
Okay.
On Friday... This is Martha Shaw. On Friday, I guess everybody might have heard that Palau and Grenada have placed a lawsuit against developed countries on climate change.
Wow.
I'm going to be writing about that on CSR. Yeah, there was a big press, and this is kind of the start of this, these small islands starting to actually do cross-border damage lawsuits. You can probably Google it. Yeah. Small island developing states are all starting to do lawsuits. It was inevitable, but it started last Friday. for real.
Wow. Okay, any other announcements? Okay, if not, we'll move on to our presentation for the day. Dave Jones from Storm Center Communications is going to be talking to us. Dave is has been an on-air meteorologist at NBC in Washington, D.C. for 10 years, and he is now CEO of a company, Storm Center Communications, where he develops technology for improving decision-making and enabling on-air meteorologists more able to communicate around weather and climate issues. I've known Dave for a long time through our partnership in the Federation of Earth Science Information Partners, the ESA Federation, which Dave was actually president for a couple of years. So Dave is going to talk to us today about engaging broadcast meteorologists in continuing education, the Glenn Gerber Weather and Climate Summit 2012. And as Dave mentioned at the beginning of this call, he is live streaming this. So if you want, he sent the email out at 12:18, at least on mine, today with the link to that live stream. So go ahead, Dave.
Okay, thanks, Tamara. I did want to mention to everybody who is on the line who might be watching the live stream to just make sure that your phones are muted so you don't get that feedback from the speakers on your PC back into the phone, and it creates that wonderful feedback that we all love during telecons. So I thought I would start and really tell you that I'm going to describe a very unique conference, and it's really known as a summit, the Weather and Climate Summit, that is focused on bringing together scientists and TV meteorologists so professional continuing education can be offered in a very unique way. I'm hoping to also stimulate some of the creative thoughts for those of you on the line, and I'd like for you to think about, as you hear me talk, about how you might see this summit contributing to the efforts that you have going on, either in your own projects or your own efforts right now, or efforts that will be kicking off before next January, because we're already in the planning stages for the Glenn Gerber Weather and Climate Summit 2013, which will also be held in Breckenridge. Just a quick note about the history. It is the 24th Weather and Climate Summit. The ones before that were mainly held at Steamboat Springs, Colorado, and the very first three or four what they were called weather summits were in Aspen a long time ago in the late 80s. And so I'll continue on now and just talk about the objectives of the Weather and Climate Summit. It was really established to bring together TV meteorologists and leading scientists and researchers from around the country. And it really allows for this dynamic and frequent interchange between those two groups so we can foster improved communication. There was a report that was put out by the Freedom Forum in the mid-90s, when I was a meteorologist on the air at NBC in Washington, where that was written, and the title was called How the Distance Between Science and Journalism Threatens America's Future. And it was all about how the media shows up to interviews with scientists, and they have these preconceived notions of a story they want to do, and all they want is for that scientist to say one or two quotes. They take those quotes and then complete their story. And that's the view that scientists have had of journalists when they come into their office to do these sort of interviews. Whereas the TV meteorologists and the journalists, they think that the scientists talk to them because they have an agenda that they want to push forward that will only further their research needs. And so the Freedom Forum report really described how that distance, how that gap is really increasing, and that there's really not a whole lot of love lost between the media and scientists. And so I really was touched by that report in the mid-90s and had tried all through my career at NBC in Washington to communicate more effectively science on the air. And now here at Storm Center, I have a team of very qualified and excited meteorologists and scientists that are share that same vision. And so the Weather and Climate Summit is about learning about technologies and research findings for improved public awareness. Also, to aid the media, the TV meteorologists, in their understanding of science, how scientists operate, how they produce information, how they conduct research, and how they communicate. And it just turns out, it's probably no surprise for most of you on the line, that scientists aren't great communicators. And so they also tend, at least in the past, to want to hold on to their data sets and hold on to their research and hold on to their results until they actually publish their paper, and then they would talk about it more. And so that has actually held back discoveries by 6 months to a year to 2 years, which is not really that great for the public at large to understand the benefits of science and these understandings. A lot of that is starting to change now, but that's kind of the way it was in the past. The attendees of the Weather and Climate Summit have goals as well. They want to learn about advanced technologies that can help them improve weather forecasting, warning, and communication. They want to understand the latest on the state of the climate and climate science research. They want to better understand how extreme weather and impacts of climate change may impact their viewers. So how can they take climate change and relate it down into a story or into issues that need to be addressed at their local level? They're not really interested in talking about climate change on a global basis, but really how can they boil it down to their marketplace? They really want more improved relationships with scientists and subject matter experts, because they need to turn to somebody and ask them questions when research questions come up, or if they have developed a relationship at the Weather and Climate Summit with a particular climate scientist, they can then interview that person, and they feel like they know them a lot more than knowing somebody who you call for the first time, like a cold call sort of thing. And they want to continue to benefit from the high quality of speakers in weather and climate science that we attract. And I neglected to mention it in the very beginning. I did want to acknowledge the support of NOAA and the Climate Program Office, David Herring in particular, for supporting the Weather and Climate Summit this year. There were two main supporters, and that's NOAA's Climate Program Office and Storm Center Communications. We both put in funding to put this summit together to motivate others in the future who may want to sponsor this and be a part of it, so they can understand how this Weather and Climate Summit happens. I would like to say a word, too, about Glenn Gerberg. This is the person who we named the summit after a couple of years ago. Glenn was passionate about weather and climate communication. He was actually one of the co-founders originally of the Weather Summit back in Aspen. He was a broadcast meteorologist on the air in Denver, Colorado from 1984 to 2001. And he was actually, prior to his passing, was being considered for a public affairs position within NOAA out there in Boulder. And he was just dedicated to really helping TV meteorologists understand the science. And so we're continuing that vision of Glenn. He passed away prematurely from colon cancer, and we miss him dearly, but we're also making sure that we carry his vision on forward. We've had a couple of other notable speakers as well in the past. Dr. Stephen Schneider from Stanford, who passed away in 2010, was a speaker in how to communicate climate science effectively. And also, more recently, we had Gavin Schmidt from NASA GIS, who, those of you who get the AGU newsletter, see that he just won the first climate communication prize from the AGU. And we had Gavin out to speak about climate forcings and model output. And so that was both Stephen Schneider. We were all, it was very fortunate for us to benefit from his wisdom and knowledge. And Gavin obviously continues his research and his effort to communicate climate science and through his blogs and websites as well. So so we've had a number of folks that have come to speak. We've had Sandy McDonald from Ezreal. We've had Marty Ralph, Tom Conway from Ezreal, Brian Norcross, who's the tropical weather specialist for the Weather Channel. We've had Jane Bullock from FEMA, when she was the deputy director of FEMA under James Lee Witt. Justin Dombrowski, who is our first responder and is now works for FEMA. Louis Uccellini, the NSEP director, Climate Prediction Center directors. We've had Andy Revkin from the New York Times at that time. Stu Ostro from the Weather Channel. And Stu is doing a lot of interesting research where he's linking weather patterns and synoptic scale patterns to climate change. And that's been very interesting as well. So about the Weather and Climate Summit, as far as the objectives and how it's put together, is it's 5 days of morning sessions. We have 2 to 3 speakers in each of the morning sessions with an average of 90 minutes to talk each day, so we have plenty of time for questions. We also stream their talks live through multiple websites. Since we attract TV meteorologists to this summit, we encourage those meteorologists to add the live streaming link into their station's website so they can promote it on the air, and then they can encourage their viewers to come in and watch the science presentations at the same time that they're sitting in the room learning as well. We have afternoon production time after lunch. We have interviews, live questions and answers sessions, and of course, we are at a ski resort, so some folks do elect to get up onto the mountain. We have evening dinners together, so we build a level of camaraderie and us talking about science with our colleagues, and we also provide a live satellite truck, to provide live shots to TV meteorologist stations across the nation. So they actually do their weather show live from Breckenridge several times during the week. And so that's why we encourage the speakers that come out to this to stay the entire week, because they may be asked to participate in a live interview about their research and about the information that they presented at the Weather and Climate Summit. So it's basically a classroom format. We cover about 50% weather and technology and 50% climate science. And we have plenty of time for discussions. And this year we even opened the doors for question and answers from the Internet audience that had chimed in and connected. So I just wanted to run through rather quickly the format of the days, because, I'd like you to think about what you think could be a very interesting and important topic to cover with these television meteorologists as we think about next year. We always start off the day with a weather briefing, and Dale Eck, the director of the Global Forecast Center for the Weather Channel, provides that weather briefing. That's about a 25-minute briefing. What weather's happening around the country, what's happening around the world that's notable, and, of course, what's the forecast for the mountains where we're located for the next couple days. We also had a speaker come in, Don Burgess from NOAA, who talked about dual polarized Doppler radar. That's a new radar that the Weather Service is now launching around the country, that they're retrofitting their existing radars, that's going to give us much more detail about the precipitation type and intensity that is happening. And as you know, with warming atmosphere and a warming planet, there are high chances, high likelihood that we'll see increased number of downpours, which also means heavy snow events and things like that, because there's more moisture in the atmosphere. So these radars are coming along at a good time. We then follow that up with a workshop on interpreting dual polarized Doppler radar output. That was from Paul Schlatter from the National Weather Service headquarters in Silver Spring. Paul spent a number of years before he came out to headquarters working on dual polarized Doppler radar out in Norman, Oklahoma. The second day, of course, we start off with the weather briefing, but we dove right into the severe weather year of 2011, and we had Greg Forbes, the severe weather expert for the Weather Channel, speak about the tornado outbreaks, the severe weather outbreaks, how anomalous they were, and then just the intensity of some of those storms, like the Joplin F5 tornado and the tornado that went through Alabama and Tuscaloosa. And April 27th was a terrible day for many people along the southeast part of the U.S. Following up from Greg was we had a 15-minute talk from Bruce Thomas, who's the chief meteorologist from Midland Radio. They manufacture a lot of the NOAA weather radios that that are distributed around the country to get access to the latest warnings from the National Weather Service. And Bruce talked about the importance of having a NOAA weather radio. And that was also brought up at the National Weather Association town hall meeting when they had lots of people from the affected areas of the severe weather and tornadoes about how did they get their warnings, and when the sirens were going off, why didn't they move? Why didn't they seek shelter? There were so many people that that were killed in that event. It's very important to understand why didn't people get the message, so we can figure out how to get them the right message. Following up from Bruce was Dan Leonard from WSI, who talked about seasonal forecasting. This is forecasting out not just days, but weeks and months, and how businesses and organizations can use that to plan for shipping either product that they have, like jackets or umbrellas or things like that they might want to put in different parts of the country, and then how tough that is to do seasonal forecasting. El Nino plays roles, La Nina, the North Atlantic Oscillation. There are all sorts of things that play into seasonal weather forecasting, and that was an excellent talk. On the third day, we had a whole day, a whole morning session dedicated to a weather technology called BuffKit, which is a software tool that you can use to slice and dice the atmosphere. And Jim Ledoux from the National Weather Service Warning and Training Decision Branch spoke in detail about how to use this software to slice up the atmosphere to really see what kind of precipitation is going to be produced, what kind of snow is going to be produced, how much, all that kind of stuff. And the attendees really appreciated that because they, in many of the TV stations around the country, they do their own weather forecasts. They just don't rip something off the teletype or get it off the internet and read it on the air. They are broadcast meteorologists, so they do create their own forecasts. On the fourth day, we dove into climate issues and climate change issues. On day four, we focused on adaptation and adapting to climate change. Tony Genitos, the director of the Joint Global Change Research Institute, spoke. He was followed up by Eileen Shea, who is in NOAA's climate program. And then following Eileen was John Furlow from USAID. And the whole idea for these series of talks was to drive home the importance of the TV for the TV meteorologists that climate change is not only is it happening, but it's affecting people in your markets, it's affecting people in the U.S., and it's affecting people around the world. How are they being affected? Because these folks don't really know. They're so focused in on their own markets. I wanted these speakers to drive home the fact that big changes are happening, causing big stresses in many areas, and so they really need to take it seriously and talk about, trying to get them to think about local series that they might want to produce in their markets that focus on adaptation, that focus on things like infrastructure and how that's going to have to change in cities like Miami and coastal locations, and how is the changing of the growing areas, that the USDA just realigned. How is that going to affect crops that people are growing, and how is it going to change the way that they farm? John Furlow brought in the whole idea of the global impacts of climate change and how people are starving and suffering and all that sort of stuff. And so I think it was a very impactful session, and we followed up in the afternoon, or in the second part of that session, with a panel discussion with those three speakers and experts. And then we opened it up to the internet viewing audience so they could then ask questions of the panelists and get those questions answered live through the live streaming. The last day, Friday, we continued on the climate change topic, and we had Dr. Jennifer Francis from Rutgers talk about the Arctic paradox. You know, what's happening up in the Arctic? What changes are going on? How does the melting of the ice, the sea ice, affect the rest of the patterns around the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere? So that was a very interesting talk. Her visuals were excellent, and she had a lot of questions from the online community as well as the TV meteorologists. And then the final speaker of the week was Dr. Jim White, who was the director, who is the director of the Institute for Arctic and Alpine Research, INSTAR, at University of Colorado. Jim spends a lot of time up in Greenland, and he does ice core drilling up at a location called Neem. The North Eemian period is what they were they're drilling for, and that is when about 250 million years ago, when the Earth was about 5 degrees C warmer than we are today. They're trying to use that time period as an analog for what we might be experiencing should the global temperatures go up by that much. And so Jim is an atmospheric chemist. He does a lot of stable isotope analysis and talked a lot about what he's finding in Greenland, how the changes are really being noticed up there dramatically and faster than anyone had ever thought. And then he is a paleo climatologist, so he goes back in time and says, look, you know, when the temperatures were this, the sea level was 60 feet higher, or it was 90 feet higher, and so, you know, we're talking about a meter rise over a period of time, but on the course that we're heading, we're going to be seeing a lot more sea level rise than that. And he's also participated on the IPCC panel of scientists with some of the writing of their reports as well. In the afternoon, we did a unique thing, which we had never done before, and that is that we invited the speakers from the morning back after lunch to have an exclusive one-on-one session with the online audience. So we invited them to come back, and we sat them up front, and we gave them microphones, and Sarah Maxwell, who is our meteorologist for Storm Center and our social media expert, was watching the questions come in and taking them in and then asking them of the panel, the panelists, and they would turn around and answer them directly into the camera. So people who were watching got a real good sense of their question being answered directly by the experts that were giving the science presentations in the morning. So we thought that was very effective, and it also made sure that people felt like they were a part of the Weather and Climate Summit. I mentioned that we had a satellite truck there for live shots. This particular graphic, which is page 14 for those of you following on the PDF document that I distributed, a number of live shots were done. They were sent back to their stations. Their news director or their anchors asked them questions about what's going on out here, and some of the meteorologists also interviewed some of the speakers as well. In the upper left-hand corner of page 15, Jay Prater was going back live to Wichita, Kansas. Another meteorologist interviewed a rescue dog and his owner, actually interviewed the owner. The rescue dog wanted to eat the microphone. We also had a number of all the seats were full in the room that we had our sessions going on. So we had, you know, a great turnout. Jim Cantore from the Weather Channel was there. That's my daughter that's with him, just in case anybody's curious. It's not a girlfriend or anything. She's only 11. But it was quite a good time, very good relationship building and very good reporting. We also received media coverage, and these are just some examples here of the media coverage from the Summit County Citizen Voice. Bob Berwin was a reporter, and he watched all of the sessions, and he wrote articles that he then published that day. And gave links to the Twitter feed, gave links to Facebook and our web page that we developed for the summit as well. So that was some excellent coverage. Also, one of the attendees, Dan Satterfield, who is a broadcast meteorologist, also writes for the AGU blogosphere. And so he wrote some blogs on some of the talks that he was seeing, and also gave us some great feedback. He said, "Dave, look, I've been to a lot of conferences, and this is one of the best ones that I've ever been to. The time that the attendees get with the scientists and all that sort of stuff is something that is really precious and something that they really value." From the standpoint of the attendees, this is an example of one of the attendees. Okay, sorry. I think the audio is gone on the stream. So, yeah, I am on the phone. So if everybody can listen through the phone, do you know why? Just dial back in again and see if it works. We're just going to dial back in again for the audio stream. So if people are watching that don't hear the audio anymore, I'll still be talking through the telephone here. Cindy Pressler from St. Louis went live, and she talked about the summit. She also thought that the effectiveness of the speakers and the format was just terrific. Jennifer Rukavina from Paducah, Kentucky, also went live every night, and she interviewed a number of the speakers. You can see her interviewing Eileen Shea from NOAA and also Dan Leonard and Greg Forbes from the Weather Channel. So there's ample opportunity for exposure, and it's a great opportunity for the TV meteorologist to turn around and then share what it is that they've learned. So at the same time, we incorporated social media into the broadcast, into the sessions itself. We had a Twitter handle for the Weather and Climate Summit, which we're going to continue into the future. We had a Facebook presence through many of the TV meteorologists, and also some of the meteorologists were writing blogs as they were listening. During the sessions, we had presentations. Those people who are watching, for example, like Jim Cantore from the Weather Channel, has 90,000 followers. So he would tweet out certain things that some of the speakers were saying, and then some of those people following him would connect right in and start the stream. We also had discussions on Facebook that went back and forth, and viewers of the live stream were able to ask questions. So they were all very appreciative online that they could participate in this whole effort. So to give you just a little bit of specifics, the summit had no advertising ahead of time. The only exposure was from social media when the TV meteorologist showed up and we started tweeting out from our handle. It was WXCS 2012, but we've since changed it. It's now WXC Summit, and that's what it's going to be well out into the future now. So if you want to connect to Twitter, that's the handle that you can connect to see periodic announcements. We also established a website, which is www.stormcenter.com/WXCS2012, and shortly that's going to be /WXC Summit to be consistent with the Twitter handle. We established a YouTube channel, so all of the presentations that were presented in the morning are now online for everyone to access and watch through the YouTube channel. And there's a direct link from the Weather and Climate Summit website as well. Their presentations, pictures, and the video were all posted the same day. The presentations are PowerPoints, so if you want to go into that site and download those PowerPoints and use any of that material for any talks that you'll be giving or materials that you need, feel free to do so. We also did the live streaming, as we're doing now for this talk, through Ustream. All in all, we had 1,600 viewers online through the live stream. This is with no real advertising, just streaming as these presentations were going on. The session videos are available. The live question and answer sessions are available. And the PowerPoints, as I mentioned, are available. And we're also planning right now for our next year's summit. So what we're doing is we're really applying lessons learned from this past summit to plan for this one coming up. Some of the things that we want to do is we want to do pre-production of stories on speakers and topics. So as we introduce those speakers, we can roll a video that is a profile of that scientist and of their research that they're doing. And that way, those packages can then be taken by the TV meteorologists and sent through their live truck back to their stations and used as a package or used as a baseline from which they can edit new packages to send back. So they can show those stories online, and we will give them to the meteorologists. We want to have additional live interaction with the online viewers. Some of the ideas that I'd like you to think about here is perhaps a way in which we can engage some schools for a special session or invite schools to watch and participate in the discussion, to perhaps have identify a town around the U.S. where we can have organize a town hall meeting where we invite people in that town. We're thinking about doing that locally in Breckenridge as well, where we have them in for an evening session so they can ask about climate change impacts. Town hall meetings in a market as a test, for example, like Miami, perhaps bring people together in one room, maybe 500 people or 1,000 people, where they can then have a local meteorologist there that's helping to coordinate it, but then have them ask questions of our live experts back in Colorado so we can have a discussion about adapting to climate change. So the local meteorologist would help to organize that and then conduct it live. That's one of the things that we're thinking about. We're also asking for input from you, the CLN members, for those of you who are thinking about ways to connect and communicate with your audience, with people in your communities. You know, we'll definitely be sharing the addresses and more information about the upcoming Weather and Climate Summit for 2013 as we get closer, so you can start to publicize it yourself and get people to connect and participate in the online discussions. If you can think of one critical topic that you would like a TV meteorologist to discuss on the air, we're very interested in knowing what you think that topic should be, because ultimately I'd like to have something boil up right to the top so we can make that a session in next year's Weather and Climate Summit. And perhaps, how can a partnership with TV meteorologists help address your challenges? So if you would like to partner with a local TV meteorologist in your market and you're not sure how to do that, maybe you have some ideas of what you'd like them to do, but we might be able to help you with some ideas about actually how to go about doing that. And so also, how might a live presentation or a discussion from the Weather and Climate Summit contribute to an increase in climate literacy where you are? So if you know that the week of January 9th to the 13th, 2013, we're going to have an opportunity to talk to a climate scientist about something that might fit into something you're organizing, then it's something that we might be able to work out and do it live from Colorado. At least it's something certainly to consider. And so if you have ideas, my email address is it's on page 24. I'm streaming it live right now, dave@stormcenter.com. Feel free to send me those ideas. And I just wanted to say as one of my last slides here that some of the other organizers put together a Glenn Gerberg Award this past summit. And they selected me to receive that award for all the work that we've been doing to get climate science and climate literacy out to broadcast meteorologists and hence to the public. So I was awarded this first inaugural Glenn Gerberg Award, and it was really touching because I knew Glenn. I was a friend of Glenn and was with him all the way, almost up until his passing. And it was really very emotional, but very it was awesome to receive something in Glenn's name. And so we're going to continue this into the future to improve ways we can communicate weather and climate, get it out to the public, and get it out to TV meteorologists. And we're hoping that next year we have a couple of additional sponsors so we can raise the quality of the video production that we do, and we can also engage more people around the country. So that's it for this part. I have one more slide after this, but I did want to open it up to some questions because I did want to turn for just 2 or 3 minutes to talk about this new initiative that's going on, this new campaign targeting TV meteorologists that are climate change deniers, and we'll talk about that in just a second. But I did want to take a little drink of water and also just open the phones for any questions if you have them. Thanks.
Well, thanks a lot, Dave, and congratulations on getting the Glenn Gerberg Award.
Thank you.
It's very interesting and exciting things you're doing. I do have a question, but I'll actually open it up first. Are there any other questions from people on the phone?
I was interested in your emphasis on the local markets that people want to be able to address. And that's also a common concern in climate change education. What kind of resources do you tap to get that local impact evidence?
Sure. That's a great question. There are a lot of things that are going on within cities and communities right now dealing with climate change adaptation. For example, how is the infrastructure for coastal cities going to be impacted by sea level rise? How are roadways, how will they need to be changed? How will, you know, the changes in temperature affect the type of crops that are going to be grown in the Midwest and in different areas of the country? So TV meteorologists are all about local. As a matter of fact, when they walk through the door every day, they're reminded to keep their weathercast local, local, local. And that's why you've seen a plethora of local weather sensors popping up around markets, located at schools, and things like that. So there are we had Tony Genitos from the Global Change Research Institute out at the Weather and Climate Summit, and he has been a part of the IPCC reports that have been put together, and he's very much focused on impacts of climate change in various regions around the country and also around the world, but really focusing on the U.S. So there are people in every market around the country, in every city, whether they're urban planners or whether they're on the mayor's team or the governor's team, thinking about how climate change is impacting their cities, because it's going to cost them money. It's going to cost them a lot of money. And so so they're through experts like Tony Genitos, David Herring at NOAA, Frank Niepold at NOAA, these guys are thinking about how climate change is impacting different parts of the country. And also the IPCC and USGCRP, they're all looking at this because it is going to have major impacts. So the key is to take what they're finding, drill it down into a region, and then go into that region, then drill it down into an area, and then say, is this particular problem a problem in my area? If it is, this is something that we should boil up to the top and make sure that people understand, the people that live there. Hey, you know, Miami, you're going to have a water processing problem and a sewage treatment problem, and the water doesn't have to rise that much to bring this problem to impact just about everybody in the city.
So, Dave, I have a follow-up question to that. This is Tamara. I know that the focus of the summit is to help meteorologists develop their science understanding of climate change, and they're also probably experts in their particular audiences in their own communities. But and you might not be able to address this in the summit, but I think it might be interesting to think about how you communicate these kinds of issues to different kinds of audiences, and your meteorologists have such a wide range of experiences, it might be worthwhile thinking about sharing the obstacles to getting that message across to particular audiences and how they might address it, and sharing that kind of experience and knowledge. Is that addressed at all during the conversations?
Well, we're certainly talking with the TV meteorologists about how to communicate climate change and get beyond the arguments of what's causing climate change. Because obviously, as you've seen across the nation, people are divided about what they believe in. And so the TV meteorologists, when they come in, they don't want to create a divide within their market. They're told from TV news directors to create a balance in the stories that they tell, and we're trying to train them that there really isn't a balance. You know, this is science, and this is what science is showing, and to take a leadership role within their station to make sure that they can communicate the science accurately and not to give voice to those who just want to create some sort of doubt in people's minds. And so we are focused on making sure that they understand the science of climate change and then how that science impacts their viewers so they can tell the right story locally about what's happening. So was that getting at your question, Tamara, or?
Yes, I think so. One of the things you mentioned in your abstract that some of the meteorologists get pressure to present both sides of the story, and as a result, they avoid the subject. And so that's another area that's a struggle to deal with. Do they?
Yeah.
You address that also?
It is a struggle for them to deal with, and there are a couple of reasons there. Meteorologists, when they get trained in college, they're not trained in climate science. They're trained in weather forecasting, and weather forecasting and climate science are two different things. So many TV meteorologists, especially ones that have been in it for, 15, 20, 30 years, have such confidence that they know everything about the weather models that they just translate that into knowledge that they think they have about the climate. And so they think, hey, we can't forecast out 10 days from now. How can we believe a climate model that goes out 10, 20, 30, 50 years from now? It's just not possible. But what they don't understand is that those models are different. They have different physics. They have different, equations and things like that for climate. That they're making that wrong leap. And that's what we need to also focus on to make sure they have the confidence to talk about climate science as opposed to talking about weather and making that seamless transition between the two.
So, thanks. Are there other questions?
Hi, this is Carol Mandrick. I have a question, but maybe this is the thing that you're going to mention next, which is the Forecast the Facts site. Is that what you were going to talk about?
Yes, it is. Uh-huh.
Okay. So I'll just wait and let you do that.
Okay, sure.
Why don't you go on to that, because we're getting close to the end of the hour. So why don't you go ahead, Dave?
Okay, that sounds great. So I just changed on the stream the graphic. There is a new campaign out. I went from the Weather and Climate Summit in Breckenridge to New Orleans to the AMS meeting. And I'm on Sunday, before the meeting even started, I'm walking through the convention center, and the executive director of the AMS, Keith Sider, comes up to me and he says, "Hey, Dave, do you know about this press release that was just issued, this Forecast the Facts thing?" And I said, I just got it on the shuttle ride to the hotel. I didn't really read it too much yet on my phone. And so he wanted to know how much I knew about it, and he told me that they were going to show up, representatives from this organization were going to show up at the AMS council meeting with 13,000 signatures of people that are demanding that the AMS make their policy statement on climate change more stringent, and holding TV weathercasters' feet to the fire to talk about climate change and talk about the facts on the air. And so I did a little bit more research, and Sarah did some research back here at Storm Center and everything. And, you know, while this campaign, you might think at the surface, is a good idea, because it's taking climate change deniers and calling them out on the carpet, it's, in my opinion, a bit, I think it's going to do a little bit more harm than good, because it's going to create more divisiveness within the broadcast weather community. We're going to continue on to do our continuing education and professional development efforts of climate and climate science and all that sort of stuff. But this one, this effort, you'll probably see in the media more and more. I can't, you know, tell you how it's going to turn out, but it's certainly something that is run more by political action groups than it is from a science side and a motivator of science. The person who's running this whole thing has no science background, and he just wants people to talk about climate change on the air and do it, you know, and even if they don't understand it or not, they should talk about the facts of climate science. So I just wanted to let everybody know, if you didn't hear about it, that that's something that's going on. It is getting more press attention because it has high-profile targets of TV meteorologists. However, I'm thinking maybe it would lead to perhaps more people wanting to attend, like the Weather and Climate Summit, so we can bring the experts and the TV meteorologists together in one room to talk about this sort of issue. So
This is Carol. I just wanted to say quickly that I totally agree with you that it could cause more harm than good. I think the people who started it have good intentions. They just don't see how clueless they are. But so I think it's really important for people who know something and people from, you know, established backgrounds like yourself and anybody else who knows anything about climate change communication, I think they should reach out to these guys and make some statements so they don't cause more harm than they're going to.
Sure. Yeah. No, that's great, Carol. Thanks very much. I appreciate that input. And anybody who has any, you know, ideas or things that you just might want to communicate to us about it, please do, because I was, you know, I'm contacted a lot by the folks at the AMS just to ask, you know, bounce questions off of and things like that. So, and maybe we can talk about it a little bit more during one of the conference calls here today. So I think we're at the 2:00, and, you know, I want to thank everybody for your time and everything. Tamara, thanks. And if anybody has any other questions, please just send me an email. I'd be happy to talk to you about them, and hopefully we can give you another exciting update a little bit further down the road in the year this year about next year's coming up.
Okay, great. Well, thanks a lot, Dave. If you could, your last slide was not on the one that was posted, so if you could add that and send it to Scott so they can post the whole thing so that the last slide will also be there available for anybody, that'd be great.
Okay. I'll put that up there as a separate slide that you can download separately there.
Okay, great.
That'll be great.
Thanks a lot. We really appreciate your call, and I hope everybody sort of takes Dave's suggestion of thinking about how you might make use of or potentially contribute to this effort. That would be great.
Awesome.
Thanks a lot, everybody.
Great.
Thank you, Tamara. Thanks,
yeah.
Everybody.
Dave, appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, Scott.